It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
An explosion of white nationalist violence, more Confederate monuments come down, and the president stumbles. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Many this past weekend saw a sight they never thought they would ever see. On Friday, several hundred white nationalists were seen carrying torches. They made their way across the University of Virginia campus in Charlottesville. They shouted slogans including "Jews will not replace us" and "Blood and Soil," reminiscent of the 1930s Germany. That was followed on Saturday by a clash of neo-Nazis and Klan members with counter-protesters. Heather Heyer was killed and 19 others injured when a car rammed through the crowd, allegedly driven by a white nationalist. The issue, the fate of a Robert E. Lee monument. But the story did not stop there. After several attempts, President Donald Trump eventually said that both sides were responsible for the violence. That was met with sharp criticism, including from his fellow Republicans who denounced the Nazis and the Klan. Here at home, Confederate monuments were moved in Baltimore, and a monument in Georgetown has also come under attack. To sort all of this out, in our studio, Clara Small, she's professor emeritus at Salisbury University. Also, Deshaun Berry, a local civil rights activist here in Salisbury. On the phone with us is Reverend Christopher Bullock with the Canaan Baptist Church in Wilmington, and Peter Montgomery, he's a senior fellow with the People for the American Way in Washington, D.C. Well, welcome to the program. Clara, I want to start with you. What was your own immediate reaction to the violence that occurred, what you saw, those images? And second of all, what was your reaction to the president's response or responses?
First of all, thanks for the invitation. But I was amazed in 2017 to see that type of violence and that type of reaction, because I thought that I hoped that at this point in time, we have learned to get along and to understand each other and to hopefully discuss things as opposed to the violence of the 1930s, the 1920s, and a period of Reconstruction directly after the Civil War. But I was not surprised, considering the racial climate in this country now. We've gone back at least 40 or 50 years. And the rhetoric that came out of the last election, presidential election, that things have become much, much worse than I originally thought. And I taught history for 44 years on the university level. So to know about the different riots, race riots, and this, my first reaction was, my God, what has happened to this country? And then the president's reaction, I didn't think it had gone far enough, but then he went backwards, which made this situation even worse. And people who thought maybe, just maybe, we're going to move forward. Most people simply said, we haven't moved forward, we've moved backwards, and it's getting worse. So I'm just, at this point in time, I am just amazed at this country and at a president who's not very presidential. And he said he wanted to unify the country. You cannot unify the country using that type of rhetoric. It's much more divisive than ever.
Deisha, you obviously are younger than both Clara and I. What does this look like from your perspective, from your view? Are you surprised? What's your sense about where we are?
I just feel like we've gone back into maybe 50, even 60 years. This is stuff that I never thought I would have to see and experience in my lifetime. It's stuff that I had to learn about in history classes. It's not stuff that I should have to see and protest against. And I believe that Donald Trump himself is not the problem. He is a symptom of where we are in America. Every time Black Americans or any kind of minority faces some kind of success in America, it's always a huge blowback. And in this case, it was Donald Trump, somebody like Donald Trump being elected into office. I'm not shocked. But I'm hurt. Hurt is the best word for it. It's not something that anybody should have to experience, and it's outraging that that it's happening in 2017 when we're supposed to be way past this, and we're going back to the 40s, 50s, 60s. It's ridiculous.
And what are we teaching our young people, the next generation? And you, racism is something that must be taught. When you have young kids, they're out there playing. They don't see color. They see someone to play with, someone to enjoy life with. But once you get to about the fifth and sixth grade and the seventh grade, that's when racism raises ugly head. And we have to do a better job as adults to try to change the fabric of this country, to change the way we look at people who happen to be different, people who have different ideas and beliefs. I was taught tolerance as a young child. I was taught tolerance, and I have taught tolerance. But the way our history is being taught now does not talk about or speak about tolerance at all. It is divisive. We have to do a better job of teaching as well, because this is not working.
I want to turn to the Reverend Bullock, because one of the things I thought was interesting is I read about some of your own reaction, Reverend, was that this has got to be more than just about the violent protest. It has to be more than just about Confederate monuments, that it has to be about policy, whether it's affirmative action, voting rights, criminal justice system. That I wonder whether or not we may get lost in looking at the shiny object, which are violence and monuments, as opposed to policy.
Well, the symbolism of the issue is strong, but we also must move from symbolism to substance, that being his policies or lack thereof. I'm concerned that we cannot defend the indefensible as relates to Charlottesville, as relates to his statements. What this country needs right now is moral clarity. Also, we need to look seriously at the fitness of the president. It's obvious that he's unfit for this office. There's a move now in Washington to censure him. There's also talk to evoke the 25th Amendment. This is very serious. The symbolism of Robert E. Lee, who was a protector and one who wanted to preserve the awfulness of slavery and the slavery enterprise, cannot defend that. That's the worst of America. We must move forward. We have to look at policies and not be distracted by what the emotion is bringing to this country, though it is real. But let's look at its policies. Trying to roll back affirmative action. We got to remove barriers to voter empowerment and registration, et cetera, et cetera. The whole issue around immigration, these are serious issues. He certainly concerns me in terms of his mental state. Secondly, just look at the reaction now beyond Charlottesville. You've had people in his own party have denounced racism, and Senator Coker and Senator Scott, the two Southern-based Republicans, denounced him yesterday. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, the military, that's very serious. That sends a strong signal. I think we're beginning to see the march toward him moving out of the White House by one way or the other. So my point is we have to look at symbolism, denounce racism, but also let's look at some substance here. And in my opinion, the president is unfit for this office. His mental state, his heart, it's all about him, and it should be about we the people, for the people, by the people.
I want to turn to Peter Montgomery. He's a senior fellow with People for the American Way in Washington, D.C. And in terms of this particular group, the alt-right, these folks that we saw in Charlottesville, how much do you think they represent the kind of support that drove the president into the White House. And I know Steve Bannon actually was quoted recently as saying that, quote, race identity politics, the left wants to say it's all racist. Just give me more, tear down more statues, say the revolution is coming. I can't get enough. And it sounds to me like, at least in Bannon's mind, and perhaps being played out by what's going on in the administration, that they're using this, that they don't see this necessarily as detrimental and perhaps something that comes out of that election last year.
Absolutely. I think that what we're seeing from the Trump administration and advisors like Steve Bannon is a new Southern strategy where they're trying to build political power by inflaming racial resentments among, you know, that part of the white population that is does not view our country's increasing pluralism and diversity as a good thing. We saw it from the very get-go in Donald Trump's campaign when he opened his campaign with a speech viciously attacking immigrants from Mexico. You know, it's not a coincidence that less than 2 weeks after he gave that opening speech, the Daily Stormer, the big neo-Nazi website, endorsed him. And throughout the campaign, the kind of rhetoric that he was using was electrifying the white nationalist movement, which until then had been, you know, they'd do their thing, but they had pretty much stayed out of politics. But they were so thrilled with Donald Trump's campaign. We had people like David Duke telling his followers to go volunteer for Trump's campaign as a way of meeting like-minded people. So I certainly would not try to say that everybody who voted for Donald Trump is part of this ideology, but his campaign energized and excited the people who were. And his rhetoric around Charlottesville gave cover to some of those people and to the violent racism that they represent. And I think that's incredibly damaging. I think even if Trump was gone tomorrow, the floodgates of this toxic stuff into our political climate is something we're going to have to live with for a long time. And history should never forget that he and his campaign ushered this violent and racist ideology from the fringes of our political life and dragged it into the place we are now.
And fear, based on fear. People are afraid of each other instead of trying to work together to make this nation a better nation. And that it has taken a large number of people working together to make this nation what it was. And his rhetoric was to make this a better country, a better nation. We were a decent nation. But at the same time, other countries are now looking at the United States and wondering, what in the world is going on?
Tisha, I wanted to ask you, when you see these Confederate monuments, we have obviously one, the Talbot Boys, obviously in Dorchester County. We have some controversy now going on in Georgetown, which we'll talk about in a moment. But what kind of reaction do you get, aside from obviously Confederate flags, which were certainly used during the opposition to integration? But what's your reaction to it?
They never really bothered me until we reached this period in America where racism is a really prominent thing, and people are using these Confederate monuments and the Confederate flag as a racist symbol. It's a symbol for white supremacy more now than ever. And I believe, like, whenever I see a Confederate monument or anything of the sort, it's intimidating. It's concerning because I know that people use this in the heights of the civil rights movement. They put these monuments up as a slap in the face to the black Americans. And now more than ever, that's starting to show and come out when people are trying to remove these monuments. The racism really comes out and it shows. And I want them removed. That's all there is to it. I don't think that those monuments honoring anyone who fought for white supremacy and the preservation of slavery should be in America. It may be in museums and history books, but statues and monuments honoring these people should not exist.
I know, as a matter of fact, I saw Michael Steele, who was a lieutenant governor here of Maryland, noted that every time he actually was sitting from he could see actually this did the statue of Justice Taney, who was author of the 1857 Dred Scott decision, from his office. He had to go by every day as an African-American, one of the first to become lieutenant governor. I want to turn to you, Reverend Bullock, because amongst other things, there's now some focus on a Confederate monument in Georgetown. There's a request by the NAACP, a demand to stop funding the Historical Society down there until they get that removed. How significant is there an effort in Delaware to get some of these things down?
I think Governor John Carney was on point when he made his statement this week that those monuments should be in a museum or in some other context. Also, we're troubled that entity has received public taxpayer dollars. I think the NAACP is right to ask for the funding to cease. Delaware, we do not have a lot of monuments, but there is a undercurrent and a subculture of racism in our state. It must be exposed. It must be dealt with nonviolently. Dr. King declared that we should try to get along as brothers and sisters or we will perish as fools. This moment in Delaware and Salisbury in this country calls for leadership, moral leadership, people of sober mind and clear who can say that our past is our past. We can't change it. We learn from it. But Dr. King's last book was entitled, Where Do We Go From Here? And we must have leadership in Washington that will point this country in the right direction. And when I say Washington, I'm not only talking about the White House, but we have three branches of government. And I'm hopeful that the Congress, particularly those in the Republican Party, will stand up with moral conscience and say that if we can't get leadership in the White House, Mitch McConnell will lead. A lot of people need to know that Senator McConnell's wife is in Trump's administration. She's a cabinet member, and I know that she's been totally impacted by this in a negative way in some of the rhetoric. So Mitch McConnell has skin in the game. Paul Ryan, we need him to step out. This is not a black or white. This is right or wrong. So those who are right should declare that wrong is wrong.
I want to turn to Peter Montgomery real quickly. What do you make of the Republican Party and its response? I mean, we have obviously people inside the administration. We hear that they're frustrated by the president's remarks and his response. There's some frustration within Congress. And yet, with a few limited voices, we don't see a lot of pushback, except to push back on the fact that various congressional GOP folks don't like Nazis and Klan members and think they should be denounced. But we haven't really seen a direct assault on or direct criticism of Trump himself, it seems. Maybe it was indirect. How do you assess politically where they are there?
Well, I think it's a really tragic failure of moral courage on a lot of the other Republican leadership. I mean, I do think we should welcome Republicans and conservatives who did quickly and unequivocally denounce the white supremacists and the violent racism at the root of what happened in Charlottesville. But, you know, in our country, that should be easy. You shouldn't get a lot of credit for saying that violent racism has no place in our public life. You know, many of these same leaders have been fully supportive of state efforts to make it harder for African Americans and young people to vote. That's another place where we come down to policy. You know, there are policies that are supported in this administration. You know, we have an Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who's trying to reverse progress that was made on mass incarceration, which has had a devastating effect on not only individual lives, but whole communities, disproportionately affecting people of color. So I think we should be glad when people from the Republican side of the aisle are clearly and unequivocally denouncing this racism, but we need to go back to them and say,
what are you going
to
do about
why
it?
Are you continuing to support this administration? Which, why are you continuing to support policies? And, you know, this is not just me as a liberal speaking. Federal courts determined that voting laws in places like North Carolina and Texas had been targeted at African American voters and Latino voters, not just that they had the effect of falling on them. So Trump is a huge part of the problem because he played up and divisive rhetoric in his campaign. He brought an energized white nationalist and white supremacist. But the problem of policy and policy that discriminates against people is a much bigger problem that the Republican Party has not grappled with, and we should hold all of them accountable for that.
Claire, I want to turn to you because one of the things that's talking about these ideas about the statues and so on, the thing that struck me is that while we have a number of statues that are coming down, all across the country, from New Orleans to Washington, D.C., to Baltimore and so on. Yeah. At the same time, we've got the Talbot Boys, which is still up. And I saw a quote from one of the city council people saying it's going to stay up. We have obviously the controversy here in Salisbury about the marker for a Confederate general who was in charge of the prisons and actually charged with some war crimes. Why, living particularly here in the Eastern Shore, is there a resistance? I mean, what kind of resistance do you see coming in this particular community? Is it difficult to come to grips with this? Is it, I mean, what, it doesn't seem as if anything's going to happen with these two things.
It should not be difficult to make a decision about it. But if you take down the statue in Talbot, what about Frederick Douglass's statue in the same area? See, when you talk about statues and Confederate statues, how many statues do you have here on the Eastern Shore of African Americans? You have Frederick Douglass in Talbot County. You have Harriet Tubman here on this campus. I mean, I think that's the only statue of a woman even on the shore. How many other statues of other people, of other ethnicities and what have you? And worst of all, how are we teaching about those individuals? If we taught the students, the community about the history of those individuals, maybe there would be a different idea or perception of what was going on during those time periods. If we taught people correctly and taught history correctly, and we taught as we were supposed to, maybe we should not have some of the problems.
Let me pose this one question though, and it's a question I pose to other people. Do you think, and particularly this area is part of the South, do you think that the South has ever come to grips with the significance of the Civil War and the crime of slavery?
No. Slavery is a question or that many people don't want to come to grips with. We're working now to make people aware that African Americans did serve in the Civil War, and that's what some of the books that we're working on are about. And I had a student in my African American history class on a Friday afternoon to say, well, blacks have never done anything in this country, and they definitely have not done anything on the Eastern Shore. Okay. My reaction was, okay, can I kill this kid? But if I did, I'd go to jail. So my, what I did was to start writing about the Eastern Shore and to make people knowledgeable about Delmarva from a different perspective. But in order to do so, you must also include the history of all people, because if you leave out one segment, you have sanitized history. And that's not what we need. We need to talk about what actually happened, how some people did come together and work together. But unless we change the way we do things, unless we change the way we look at other people who happen to be different, regardless of this, their gender, regardless of their religious beliefs and ethnicities, we are working backwards. And someone will simply say, well, why do we need that? Well, we need that to try to understand each other. I'm a mutt. I mean, African-American, Native American. My great-grandfather was white. And, I mean, a combination. And so I've always been taught intolerance. And I see people. I don't see color. I don't see gender. And that's the way I taught. Maybe I'm a little bit strange, but I'd rather be strange than to be a crazy person. Sorry. I didn't mean to go that far with it.
That's okay. We've been speaking with Clara Small. She's Professor Emeritus at Salisbury University. Daisha Berry is a local civil rights activist. Also on the phone with us was Reverend Christopher Bullock. He's with the Canaan Baptist Church in Wilmington. Also Peter Montgomery, a senior fellow with People for the American Way in Washington, D.C. I want to thank all of you for joining us and having this really interesting discussion.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Our human ancestors hunted and gathered. They survived and reproduced. And one day, they began to ask, why? I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, spacious conversation about meaning, faith, and the immensity of 21st century lives. A journey of discovery from American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7 FM, putting Delmarva first.
Wacomico County will be 150 years old, and local officials and residents are celebrating. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It's 1608. The famous John Smith sailed up the Nanticoke and Wacomico Rivers. British soldiers and settlers began arriving under land grants from Lord Baltimore, and the rivers were key transportation conduits with the town of Salisbury, which was incorporated in 1854. The region itself was sympathetic to the Confederate cause, but also produced such likes as Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. It was not until after the Civil War in 1867 that Wacomico County was carved out of Somerset and Worcester counties. Salisbury became the seat of the county government. To mark the 150th anniversary, in our studios, we have Dr. Creston Long. He's director of the NAB Center, and also Zach Evans. He's chair of the Wacomico County Fair. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Creston, I'm going to start with you. And one of the basic questions is, how did it come about that Wacomico County got carved out of these two other counties? What were the political and economic dynamics there?
Okay. Well, there's several things. It's 1867. So I want to point out that's just a couple of years after the end of the American Civil War. So really, this is a time in which the country is recovering from that. The center portion of the peninsula, so this area where we're southern Delaware through what was then Somerset and Worcester County, that had continued to grow and expand economically in the previous few decades. So remarkably, through the Civil War, there had been an expansion of the railroad into this portion of the peninsula from northern Delaware. Right on the eve of the Civil War, about 1860, it stopped at the Delaware state line. And, that year it extended down to Salisbury. By the end of the war and the creation of Wacomico County, it had extended down through Somerset and Worcester County towards Pocomoke City. So the extension of that railroad really allowed this area to connect in with much larger markets to the north and to the west, the major metropolitan areas of Philadelphia, New York, Baltimore, Wilmington. That combined with the modernization of the United States because of the Civil War. That brought this area to an interesting time, economically speaking. So we've got a city of Salisbury that was essentially and literally divided between two counties, Worcester County to the east, and Somerset County on the west side. And what we know as Division Street today, that was literally the dividing line between the two counties. But right in the center of this area was this growing urban area of Salisbury. So it was difficult to conduct business in this growing commercial area if the county courthouses were dozens of miles away. So Snow Hill in the case of Worcester and Princes Anne in the case of Somerset County, to conduct business and to grow, it helps to actually be closer to the county seat. This is a problem that we can see all across the United States when it comes to expansion and the creation of new counties. It's a similar impulse. The desire is to create and subdivide additional counties so that access to land records and the county courthouse to judicial rulings is much closer. So in 1867, there was a new Maryland Constitution that was drafted, and it included language that allowed the subdivision of Wicomico County out of Somerset and Worcester counties. So it's in that year that there was an opportunity to do this, and there was an effort to organize pro-division voters out of this portion of Somerset, this portion of Worcester. They voted, and it was agreed that there would be a new county.
Was that generally the sentiment in the area? Was there any opposition, or was
there,
it really
generally?
There
was generally, some.
What was that about?
Was there just some. And we have to imagine that, you know, there's a connection to the former county, right? There, it could be familial connections. I'm not going to be able to give you precise reasons for this, but if for whatever reason families in the sort of the southern end of Somerset had family connections further south, closer to Princes Anne, this might not have seemed quite as necessary to them, or business connections. So that certainly could be an issue. The counties that were already in existence, Somerset and Worcester, not all of the residents of each county got to vote on this. It was the residents in the portion that would become the new county. Had it been a larger vote, including all voters in both counties, there might have been greater opposition because of loss of tax base, loss of land, that sort of thing. But in the end, it was a fairly healthy majority that in both counties that led to the subdivision.
So what was this area then like? I mean, we've talked a little bit about the railroad coming in, and obviously that's beginning to transform the region. But at the same time, we note that the region itself was still fairly cut off. I mean, obviously, we don't get the bridge until many years later. So this is still a fairly isolated area.
On the one hand, it was, because we don't see a large what we think of as a modern connection like a railroad. But something I always emphasize is that there was steamboat traffic fairly regularly at this point. And even going back to the colonial period, there was waterbound transportation. There was a network of roads. I wouldn't really call it a system, but there were connections between this area and Philadelphia even during the colonial period. So I don't want to overstate the whole isolation part. It was never total. But certainly the extension of the railroad was going to speed things up quite a bit. During this time, the years leading up to the war and right after, this area was a major agricultural area and timber producer. Timber was becoming a big business in this portion of Delmarva, and a lot of trees that were harvested here and milled were put in buildings in New York City and Philadelphia. That connection, this new connection, the railroad, helped speed up that whole process. The movement of fruits and vegetables directly out of fields onto the streets of New York City, sometimes the very next day, that was enabled by the railroad. So the makings of Salisbury economy were there. They'd been there for decades, agriculture, timber. The extension of, again, these more modern forms of transportation sped up that process. And then towards the end of the decade, when the railroad was extended down through what remained Somerset County to Crisfield, that started to develop seafood as a major industry. So there was a bit of seafood production here in Salisbury and Wicomico as well.
So what was the cultural atmosphere like? What's the history for the people here? I mean, we talked a little bit about that. They weren't quite so isolated, but there clearly was a, as you mentioned a moment ago, this is interconnection of a lot of families who've been here a very long time. Mm-hmm. You can even see it today in the roads and the people who certainly occupy political offices and leadership. Their families really stretch back. What kind of culture are we looking at? I mean, obviously, they're also coming out of the slave era, which at least was not dominant, but certainly mm-hmm. was a present. Yeah.
Well, so again, going into the Civil War, Wicomico doesn't exist as an entity, but Somerset and Worcester counties, there were several thousand slaves in each of those counties going into the war. There was also a sizable free African-American population in both counties, and you don't really find that much farther south of here. That's where Maryland becomes distinctive. If we're looking at the United States in that lead up to the Civil War, Maryland has a substantial free African-American population alongside a substantial and about equally sized enslaved population. So that makes Maryland distinctive in a way. We've got, obviously, there's a reason why there was an enslaved labor force. There was still heavy agriculture here. No cotton production here. People sometimes assume that was all over. That was not the case here.
Or tobacco, for that matter.
Not by that point, certainly. But, you know, clearly agriculture was a major part of that. These influences from Baltimore and Philadelphia shouldn't be forgotten. Maryland was an industrializing state by this time. You don't find that south of here either. That looks more, that has more of a middle Atlantic northern feel to it than, say, North Carolina or South Carolina or many parts of Virginia. It was culturally, it is hard to pinpoint down that, to really pinpoint that. Right. I know that's unsatisfying for many people. They wanted to. This was a southern place, or this was not. It was, you know, many immigrants here, and it was more northern. It was a real blend, and that would have been visible in the broader population, not in the voting population at this point. That still would have been incredibly restricted. That was white men. So we shouldn't confuse those two. But influences from metropolitan areas from the north, there was a clear commercial connection between this area and those places, and that would have been a part of people's life here. They would have known that the fruits and vegetables they were growing were heading north. The timber that they were producing, a lot of that was building cities. So I think there would have been a real cultural blend here. Certainly, though, with a southern feel to it at times, and but also a sense of change.
Well, obviously, one of the major industries is the poultry industry. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions I've always posed is there any special reason why poultry should have been here in the first place? Obviously, now we've got this entire infrastructure that's now built around it.
Right.
What was the impetus and why was it so easy, do you think, for poultry to grow? Obviously, much of it centers around the Perdue family, mm-hmm. who is now one of the dominant economic engines, certainly here. How did that develop? Why is it that we seem to be so amenable to it and its growth?
Well, that comes about later. That's a 20th century phenomenon, and really a couple decades into the 20th century is when poultry production becomes something that is more of an industry and becomes big business here. It starts to emerge then. Yeah, I certainly think that the land itself is amenable to growing food for the chickens. That's clearly a major. The predominant portion of our agriculture goes towards poultry production in one way or another, whether it's raising the chickens themselves or producing feed for them. So certainly, I think the land itself was part of that, but these transportation advances clearly are part of it as well.
So at this point, do you think that there's this distinct difference between what seemed to be the requirements when poultry began, as opposed to, say, now we jump to, say, the 2017, where mm-hmm. we now are much more concerned about the Bay, much more concerned about agriculture and its impact. And there seems to be, as if when it was created or when it was put forth that we should, you know, involve ourselves in poultry, now we're this sort of 100 years later and we say, well, maybe maybe not so much. I mean, there seems to be a much different, you know, environmental impact than it, say, was even then.
Oh, okay. So, well, I mean, we've seen by this point, over the course of just shy of 100 years, we've seen the relatively slow beginning emergence of the industry, in some ways, the consolidation of it. And we would have found more smaller chicken producers back several decades ago. And that's generally over the course of the 20th century moved into the hands of a relatively small number of larger companies. And I'd say that's still the predominant model at this point. So I don't think it's anywhere near a point of being in decline, but there are experts who study this far more than I do that could speak better to this than I can.
Hey, what about agriculture in general? Did that change in terms of what was produced?
Yeah, there are huge differences there. And if we were to look at agricultural census schedules from the late 1800s, what we would notice is that farmers here produced all sorts of produce and grains and potatoes, and there were some that specialized in sheep raising. It was a very diverse place, and that's what would stand out to people. Anyone who pays attention today and drives along Route 50 and looks at the fields, as I hope people do, because they're usually beautiful, right? There's something to see there. They would notice it's predominantly soybeans or corn, if they know what they're looking for. 100 years ago, or even much less than that, actually, you would have seen far more vegetable production, fruit orchards. This area where we are right now, there were orchards in the area adjacent to what's now Salisbury University. It was a far different place. I mean, the town just south of us, Fruitland, it takes its name from what was growing on the land. The ability to pick vegetables and fruits, can them right in the area. There were canneries all around this region in the late 1800s through the much of the 20th century. The ability to do that and then pack them to ship across the country, that's what sustained agriculture here for a long time. So it would have looked very different. It would look much more diverse than it is
today. And what kind of, finally, along this line, what kind of impact was there in terms of the watermen, in terms of mm-hmm. crabbing, that kind of thing? Because we're fairly inland in many ways.
True, right? But if we look at a map that was drawn in the late 1870s, there are maps covering the Eastern Shore in this the 1877 Atlas. If we look at Salisbury, there were oyster packing houses right in downtown Salisbury. There were ice houses adjacent to them. So even during that fairly early time, when seafood is really taking off in a big way further south of here in Crisfield, here in Salisbury and then out on the Nanticoke River, there were fisheries and there were canning operations. And it certainly was a part of the economy here. It really, you're right, though. I mean, it we would have to look out a bit closer to the bay to see the real impact of that. But that's the other big economic development in the late 19th century on Delmarva, is the explosion, namely of oyster harvesting. And then later in the 20th century, we'd see crabbing emerge.
I want to turn, by the way, one more time to the issue of race, because we obviously had the lynching in 1931 mm-hmm. of Matthew Williams. And describe, obviously, the events surrounding that. What do you think drove that kind of thing? What was the status of race relations? And as I think we mentioned before we started the interview, then it really sort of made H.L. Mencken famous, because he was an editor of the Baltimore Sun and wrote extensively Certainly. About this particular issue with very unkind words, I might say, right. for the Eastern Shore.
Well, it broader historians of American history usually point to the 1920s as one of the low points of race relations in the country. There is, during that decade, a spike in the number of lynchings. It was a horrible period. This is also the decade in which an invigorated Ku Klux Klan was out in the open. I mean, there are famous pictures of rallies on Pennsylvania Avenue, parades. I mean, that was the 1920s. So 1931, early December, is when Matthew Williams was lynched in downtown Salisbury. It had stemmed from an event earlier in the afternoon, a shooting that, you know, one of the things when there's a lynching, there's the death of the victim who's being lynched, but there's also the death of any chance of finding the truth about what really happened. Nothing regarding that initial incident never went to trial. So we don't know who was responsible for the shooting earlier in the afternoon. That is lost to history. But the lynching occurred that night, again, early December 1931. And then in the couple of days after that, that is when reporting on the lynching went in two very different directions. If we look at local reporting, there was some reporting, but it was rather vague in detail. And then there was reporting developing from outside of the immediate area. And the most famous of that comes from the Baltimore Sun and H.L. Mencken. And from that point on, really, it develops into really a conflict almost over culture. We see virtually no attention to the victim, Matthew Williams, in the reporting. It becomes this war of words between local outlets here and metropolitan papers like the Sun, and it becomes something of a culture war in the early 1930s. Now, there'd be a lynching a couple of years later, 1933, just down in Prince's Anne. So again, it's a period in which this was fairly common, and these were the last lynchings in Maryland. But I see it as the back end of that period, and with it, it takes communities a very, very long time to come to grips with that sort of an event.
Because I know, for instance, obviously there's been some debate about having a marker, for instance, to mark where he was lynched, which was outside the courthouse.
Yes.
Being so close and this community being so intertwined in terms of family members, I mean, I know some folks have said they may have had family members
Certainly.
Who actually were at the lynching. Do you think that's one of the reasons why we still have a difficult time, particularly here in Wicomico County, but in general in terms of the Eastern Shore, of coming to grips with the passage, because it is so personal?
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's difficult for many people to get their minds, first of all, around the brutality of an event like that, just to even imagine it and visualize it, but then to consider that people in maybe a generation or two older were perhaps directly involved, or witnesses were yeah. there and watched or watched and did nothing, which, you know, was the case with the crowd. That is a difficult thing. And there have been a number of discussions about commemorating this event or trying to come to grips with it, but it took a very long time to even be able to talk about it.
But finally, turn to the bridge. Some people on the Eastern Shore said it was the worst thing that ever happened. All of us started coming across the bridge. What kind of impact do you think the opening of that bridge, and obviously more and more people coming to the shore, and just in recent years, we've had a lot of retirees who have been coming to the shore. What kind of impact do you think that's been had on the shore, and what kind of future does that mean in terms of the kind of localized provincialism that we've seen in the past?
Well, I mean, it added a link that was going to be used for commercial purposes, also for recreation. I mean, I see there had been a tourism business here before the bridge, but it could explode after that. I mean, and that's continued to grow over time. That I'd say is one of the big areas of impact. But again, clearly commercially, I see that as it added another link. We've already talked about water transportation. We've talked about rail. It was not an isolated area before, but this allowed trucking of a much larger size to have easier access to the shore. So clearly the bridge, and then it's the addition of the second span in the 1970s, that's